It's time for the book interview.
Boring books, that's all.
Books? Are you nuts?
No, nothing boring here. Money Life will bring you a book that is out right now. A book that will help you learn more about your finances.
A book that would make Ulysses look like it was written in crayon.
Smart books by smart authors that can help you decide how to best manage your money.
It's not a book! It's a weapon!
It's a weapon against making the kind of mistakes that people make in their financial lives. Money Life brings you the books, the authors, and the information to protect you from these missteps and help to keep your financial future secure.
I read your book. I liked it very, very much.
Don't just take it on faith. Hear the authors talk in depth about their books and give you the facts and figures to back up their information.
It's faith. It's the flower of light in the field of darkness. It's giving me the strength to carry on. You understand?
Is that from your book?
No, it's Johnny Cash, Live at Folsom Prison.
Welcome to the book interview on today's show. And you know, if you listen to the show regularly, that I love nonfiction writing, that I love especially, you know, historic nonfiction books, and that, of course, I'm a past president of the Society of American Business Editors and Writers, and I get all geeked up about journalism and journalism issues. Well, I'm really excited about the book we're talking today because it brings all those things together. My guest is Rob Wells. He is the author of The Enforcers: How Little-Known Trade Reporters Exposed the Keating Five and Advanced Business Journalism. Rob is an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas. You can learn more about the book by finding him on the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page, where you will find a long link to the University of Illinois publishing arm and the publishing page for the book. And oh, by the way, he's on Twitter. He's at rwells1961. But right now, he's on Money Life. Rob Wells, good to talk with you.
Hey, Chuck. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, like I said, I get geeked up on this because, A, I love financial history, and I'm old enough to remember the Keating Five and Charles Keating and sort of all of the miscarriages of justice. But then when you put it all into modern texts and contexts, you've got issues where back when that story was broken, it was, as your book points out, broken by trade reporters, not the mainstream media, which is pretty important in a world where the mainstream media seems to be dying, taken as fake news all the time, etc. So for you, is this more the business history lesson, or is this more modern journalism lesson?
Well, it's both. What's really interesting is this small trade publication. It was National Thrift News, was specifically designed for mortgage executives. You couldn't buy it on the street in Manhattan. You couldn't. It was it's a pure trade paper with about 12,000 circulation, came out every other week. Small paper, and this is during the heyday of big, large newspapers with investigative reporting teams and money and junkets that they used to send reporters to. And with all this money and all these resources, this small paper was able to go ahead and break really what I argue is one of the iconic money and politics scandals in the 1980s. So it's about history. It's also, when you look at this small paper, you look about how innovation can happen in very small newsrooms if you have the right people in charge. And I argue you need to have the journalists in the ownership structure of a publication to really make a big difference.
Well, National Thrift News got hammered by its industry. Like, all sorts of people were saying, you shouldn't be doing this, if I recall correctly. And of course, you know, so much the trade press is kind of, you know, considered like the fluff of an industry. But at this modern times, anybody who's covering anything anywhere needs to look, because there's a pretty fine line that a lot of people are walking. So let's do a little bit of the history here. I remember, of course, the Charles Keating story. Charles H. Keating, who was a known athlete, renowned athlete when he was in college, and was a big donor to Catholic causes, if I'm not mistaken, and then he wound up running American Continental Corporation, which bought Lincoln Savings and Loan, and that marriage right there became a match made in hell for the investors and everybody else. Pick up the story and help my audience understand sort of where the frauds came in.
So Keating had already encountered the Securities and Exchange Commission in 1979 in Cincinnati with a problem with a stock transaction and had to settle with the SEC, picked up stakes and moved to Phoenix, acquired this American Continental Corporation. So it already had some problems with the law to begin with. This was the period where Keating, when he purchased Lincoln Savings and Loan, this is during the first great deregulation of the banking industry since basically the Great Depression. And they had allowed non-commercial enterprises to come in and purchase insured savings institutions. So Keating was able to use Lincoln Savings and Loan to help bankroll some investments in commercial real estate and also to help support some junk bond financing. What happened was there were a lot of real estate transactions happening, particularly in the Southwest, in Texas, Los Angeles, California, Southern California, and Arizona. And there were very inflated real estate values that were happening that were matched with the economics of the time, and a lot of speculation going on. So basically what was happening was you had highly leveraged financing going into speculative real estate projects, and the investors who were buying into these things weren't getting, full disclosure on the amount of leverage and the rotten economics of some of these big projects.
The thing that folks may remember out of this story as well is what became known as the Keating Five. But they probably won't remember who the Keating Five was. They'll think, wait, Charles Keating, bad guy, had a group of bad guys. They were called the Keating Five, except for the fact that the Keating Five were U.S. senators. How did they all get looped in? And how much of this was uncovered by the trade paper versus the mainstream media once it finally became the big national story that it grew into?
So the Keating Five were five U.S. senators. It was Alan Cranston from California, John McCain and Dennis DeConcini from Arizona, John Glenn from Ohio, and Don Riegel from Michigan. And these five senators had all been receiving campaign contributions from Charles Keating. Keating was a major figure in Republican politics from the 1960s forward. Due to his Catholic faith, he was very involved in the anti-pornography movement and had created this outfit called Citizens for Decency and Literature, and had testified before Congress and had brought Supreme Court cases. And all that is really important because it helped found his political foundation in Republican politics. So what the Keating Five were important figures because Keating at this point was trying to pursue these really aggressive real estate ventures. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which was this regulator, was trying to dial it back, trying to slow down some of these real estate transactions, trying to shut down a couple big projects. And so he had tried to get the Federal Home Loan Bank Board to back off. When that didn't work, he brought in five U.S. senators to meet with the regulators in an extraordinary episode of political interference in a regulatory process. Just an amazing meeting in April of 1987. The National Thrift News heard about this and was able to obtain a transcript of the meeting. There was one of the lawyers in the meeting that took very good notes, or according to one of my sources, he may have actually been wearing a wire. And he had a very detailed transcript. The Thrift News got a hold of this transcript and then published a story in September of 1987. My reporting shows that Jack Anderson's publication was aware of this but was unable to publish because of warnings from its libel lawyers, and that a freelance writer named Michael Binstein, who worked for Anderson, had approached other newspapers without success. So it was sort of out there a little bit in the freelance community, but no one had picked it up. What is especially surprising to me is the National Thrift News breaks the story about five U.S. senators interfering in a regulatory matter against involving a really controversial developer, and the mainstream media basically ignored this story for the next year, and there's no follow up. But it is at the same time they were reading the National Thrift News. I knew that. I was able to nail that down. So here is this extraordinary reporting done by this little newspaper that everybody should have followed up on, and there was no. There was really no pickup until the regulators finally shut down Lincoln Savings loan in April 1989.
Yeah, and by the way, it was bipartisan. The Keating Five had members of both parties.
Four
Democrats and a Republican.
Yeah. McCain was the only Republican. All the rest were Democrats. Yep.
So, but it was bipartisan, and you can't get them to agree on anything. So somebody should have said, okay, back in, in terms of how it all ended up, I remember Mother Teresa came in and asked at one point for leniency for Charles Keating because he had done whatever. He wound up being convicted. Then it was mostly technicalities, if I recall the case correctly. They were overturned. He wound up agreeing to a plea bargain, but ultimately, because of overturned convictions, if it weren't for the plea bargain, and he did serve some time as a result of that, he would have wound up getting away scot-free, right?
Right. Well, he did spend some time in prison, several years in prison, and you're right, there was a an appeals process, and he was eventually released. He didn't spend his full term. But unlike the 2008 financial crisis, he did spend some hard time behind bars, and there weren't a lot of senior executives from the 2008 crisis that went to jail.
Let's talk in the limited time we have left about where you think journalism is today. I mean, you obviously are teaching journalism to the next generation of journalism students. And when somebody comes up and tells me they want to be a journalist, I say, I hope you know the important phrase. And they say, what is that? And I say, would you like us to upsize your order? Because most people who are studying journalism are going to wind up as coffee baristas or what have you. How worried are you for the state of journalism? I mean, how worried are you that the next Lincoln Savings is out there, the next Keating Five issue is out there, and because of the shrinkage of mainstream media and everything else, things can't be done? Or is it going to be bloggers, podcasters, people working in little corners that other folks, decry as conspiracy theorists or whatever, that are going to be the ones breaking news in the future?
We are going through a seismic shift in journalism and its business model. It started when I was at Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal in the mid-2000s with the decline in the print advertising and classified ad. We have not still found the new financing model for traditional and digital journalism going forward. So, yes, I'm very concerned about the future of journalism and its financing. What I want this book to inform the public is on this critical point. We in this new era need to be paying closer attention to specialized publications. In the trade press, we need to be paying closer attention to bloggers and podcasters, because innovation and watchdog journalism may be coming from somewhat obscure places, but we can't just dismiss out of hand because they don't have a brand name. There could be very, very good journalism happening in the trade press or in the blogosphere or on podcasts. And what I'd like to see is partnerships between these innovative small newsrooms and the larger mainstream media outlets to distribute this. I'm seeing some of that with ProPublica,
right,
and the trade press. ProPublica has teamed up with the American Banker, for example. These stories get distributed on large platforms such as the Washington Post. We need to have more of that. And there's some institutional and traditional barriers in mainstream media that prevent these partnerships. And those need to be torn down immediately.
And the book talks all about it. The book is The Enforcers: How Little-Known Trade Reporters Expose the Keating Five and Advanced Business Journalism. It's out today from University of Illinois Press. Rob Wells, thanks for joining me to talk about it.
Chuck, this is great. Thank you very much.